Tonight on Banfield, at the mercy of Vladimir Putin, for Americans captured in Ukraine or arrested in Russia, there is no easy way out, especially if you're calling the U.S. Embassy on a weekend. Also ahead, who's up for a business trip? It's not what you think, unless, of course, you've been on a psychedelic retreat with your coworkers. Yes, it really is happening. Would you trip with your boss to keep your job? And later, the custody battle you have to see to believe, and then, even when you see it, you won't believe it. Big new developments in the case of the statutory rapist who is raising his victim's daughter. And if sky-high gas prices are draining your wallet, we know a guy who can help. He's in Phoenix, but you can meet him right here, this hour, on Banfield. Hello and welcome to Banfield. I'm Brian Enten, in tonight for Ashley. Tonight, both the White House and the State Department, they are doing damage control after screwing up the first good thing to happen to Brittany Griner since she was arrested in Russia back in February. The U.S. considers the seven-time WNBA All-Star wrongfully detained for allegedly carrying cannabis oil in vape cartridges. Well, Saturday was Griner's fourth wedding anniversary, for which the Russians finally allowed her a phone call. It's her first time she was able to get on the phone since being arrested with her wife, Sherelle, in the U.S., but it never even happened. The call was being routed through the U.S. Embassy, and because it was a weekend, nobody was even there to answer it. Brittany tried calling 11 times. The White House calls it a, quote, unfortunate mistake, when the State Department says that it deeply regrets. Sherelle Griner, as you can imagine, is absolutely fuming.
So Saturday would have been the first time that I've heard BG's voice since, February the 17th. She was only allowed to call the number given directly to the embassy, and they did not answer. I find it unacceptable on our embassy, on all the government personnel that keeps telling me that my wife is a priority. How could she be a priority when in the same breath that you're telling me that, you're also not even checking something as simple as the fact that we scheduled a call during a non-business day? It's ridiculous.
Can you imagine? Supposedly, a call is now being rescheduled. But Griner, of course, is not the only American in Russian hands tonight. At least two and likely three U.S. citizens who went to fight in Ukraine are being held there as well. Grady Gerpasi, an ex-Marine, went to Ukraine in March and has not been heard from since April. Andy Hyun, also a former Marine, and Alexander Druk, ex-Army, got separated from their unit last week and popped up on Russian TV on Friday. The U.S. considers all of them prisoners of war, and thus they are entitled to the rights and protections of the Geneva Conventions. Russia considers them soldiers of fortune and subject to trial, imprisonment, and even possible execution. My first guest has lived their story, or one very, very close to it. In 1999, Andrew Ramirez was a U.S. Army sergeant who spent a month in a Serbian prison, and he joins us now tonight. Andrew, I can only imagine when you hear these stories, when you hear any story of an American locked up overseas in a situation like that, it's got to just bring everything that happened to you flooding back.
Oh, I mean, it sure does. Even watching the images of, the man being taken from one place to another, it's very striking.
And Andrew, I spent the day researching what you went through, and it's just terrifying. I mean, you were in this Humvee entering a village. You take on enemy fire. Your Humvee is disabled, and you're no longer able to drive. You're driving, and you end up crashing the Humvee. Take me through what happened from there.
So we were, routine patrol, just coming back through on a route reconnaissance. They had to show me the route back through, same way we had come. We'd come through that same village. Next thing we know, when we drove through the village right in the sort of the middle on, edge of the town there, there was an ambush that was set up for us.
So an ambush was set up for you. And so you're in the Humvee realizing that you're basically stuck. And then what happens?
So we took so much small arms fire, and they disabled the vehicle. So we ended up crashing into a bush. They approached us. They're still firing their weapons. There was, explosions around us. So, it was just, them as a matter of time. They, ended up taking us, dragging us out of the vehicle. As I tell people, they welcomed us, in a special way. They ended up taking us around the corner, and they had us there around by on our knees by a farm or a sort of a horse stable. We really thought that was the last of us. I was sitting there, I was in the middle, kneeling, and I thought I was going to see one of my friends get shot, killed right in front of me, and expecting myself to be next.
Yeah, I can't imagine being tied up and blindfolded. I can't even imagine what you would be thinking in that moment. At what point are you then taken to the prison?
So we spent 7 days approximately being interrogated. So we were moved around the, some city. We still don't know exactly where. They had us bound, our legs bound, our heads covered. They had us lying on the ground, or they had us sitting, and they would interrogate us. Not much food, not much water. And, they, for those days, they had a lot of questions that we just could not answer because we weren't who they thought that we were. They thought we were pilots. They thought we were special forces. They thought we were anything except for some, regular old scouts that were in an observation post. And after that, those days of moving us around, they finally just threw us into a vehicle and drove us to a prison.
And to just think that the entire time the images of you were shown on television back here in the United States, and your family and your mother was watching that, obviously something you didn't realize at the time. But while you're going through this anguish, I can't even imagine what your family was also going through.
Yeah, my family had everyone told me their stories. Friends, family told me the stories of turning on the television or watching television and seeing that picture there on the shirt. Of me, on TV, and then the other three, my other two friends with me, and they had no idea what happened. They had no idea that I was even, taken or if we were dead at some point, because they really didn't have too many answers. And so when we popped up on TV, it was, bittersweet because, well, it showed that we were alive, but, it showed also then that we were, in the hands of the enemy.
So when you're in the prison for weeks, how are they treating you? And how did you not give up in that moment? I mean, it must have felt so hopeless at times.
So for the first 7 days of them moving us around, and keeping us bound and heads covered, I mean, that was terrible because I was so disoriented. I had no idea where I was or, my mind was playing some strange tricks on me. Sitting in the prison was a lot different, because we were just, we're just sitting. You can hear other prisoners. We could hear activity around us. There were guards that, they didn't keep us bound or our heads covered. So, we're free to roam around our little prison cell. We were separated. I hadn't seen Stone or Gonzalez, but I knew that they were around just from, interactions I had with the guards. Some of the guards were, did their normal guard duty. These other couple of guards, didn't seem to like us very much. And so, we had the same story of how these two would come through and make, some visits when their commander was gone, and sort of, rough us up, not to make it so obvious, but, they had their fun, I guess.
Ugh, it's sickening to think that you describe it as them having their fun. As someone who's been through this, Andrew, what's your advice to other people being held overseas, to the Brittany Griners, and to the people all over the world held as POWs like this? What do you say to them?
Every situation, is different. Everybody's going to of course, be different. Brittany Griner is an athlete. She's not a military person. She's not somebody who, was trained to do any of this. The other gentleman, I'm not sure of their military background fully, but, obviously they had more training. You got to keep your head up. You have to keep faith. You have to just know that everybody knows what's going on with them. They have to believe that people would like them, their loved ones, their country would like them to be home. And, that their family is doing everything that they can to make sure that we remember them. We don't forget them. That was the hardest thing, because I really sat there and thought, who knows if people even understand or have any idea what happened to us. We didn't realize it was such a big group of people, such an outpouring of support for my family back here in the United States, and for my friends' families, of course.
Well, thank goodness you're okay, Andrew. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us tonight, and thank you for your service to our country.
Well, thank you, sir.
I want to bring in now Hal Kempfer. He is a retired Marine Corps intelligence officer. He's currently CEO of Global Risk Intelligence and Planning, an expert on all of this. Hal, first of all, I want to start off with something that I just couldn't believe, that Brittany Griner is in prison in Russia. She gets the first chance to call her wife, and she can't get through because there's no one at the embassy on a weekend. There's no one at the U.S. embassy on a weekend. What did you think when you first heard that?
Well, my first thought was there's going to be a lot of heads rolling at the embassy, proverbially speaking. Obviously, for State Department, this is a huge embarrassment. One of the challenges with the war and everything is the downside staffing of our embassy in Moscow and all the issues dealing with that. And, the coordination on this one is just a little bit stunning, considering particularly how profile it is, but also how important it is. You have a U.S. citizen, in Russian custody at this time, under questionable reasons why she is in custody. The rumors that they want to, that she's there to exchange for a Russian arms dealer. So there's kind of a not confirmed, but sort of a deal on the table to get her out and stuff. So there's a lot of questions to go with this. But I got to say, at the very least, State Department should have been on its game. And weekend is no excuse for not manning those phones.
Yeah, they certainly were not on their game, it appears. And like you said, high profile. You would think they would have someone there to answer the call when she finally gets a chance to call out of the prison. I want to ask you, Hal, obviously she's a WNBA player, high profile, but still just a U.S. citizen compared to some of these other POWs who are obviously people who have been in the military. What's the difference in terms of how our government treats the situation?
Well, we'd like to see all Americans that are held to be released back to the U.S., regardless of their status. But her situation, she is not a combatant. She's not in the war zone. She was picked up. Now, the part of the problem the Russians have is they say they picked her up for having cannabis oil. And one can go into the discussion, well, it's legal in the States or whatever. It's not legal. And if you're traveling with that, that's a really bad idea, because that can happen in a lot of different countries. But the Russians have been so over the top in their statements, it's very difficult to believe the veracity of anything that they say. So this could have been planted. This could have been a whole setup for all we know. With that said, we want to get her back. And the fact that they have ostensibly, although not confirmed, because things like this are never really known until they're known, if you know what I mean, that there's an arms dealer they want to release, it really does kind of smell like that she's being used as a bargaining chip to get somebody back.
And you're right. We do want to get her back, obviously. But how often are POWs and people held in prisons like this in Russia and other countries, how often are they not released?
Well, if they're a prisoner of war, that's a different status. She is being held in custody like a criminal defendant would be in any country. And that happens all over the world. There's countries that have Americans in their prisons serving sentences. And in many of those countries, we have a pretty good relationship with those countries. And in many cases, shocking but true, we have Americans that go overseas and they do criminal acts and they end up in a foreign prison. These things happen. The difference is with the Americans who are prisoners. They were fighting for the Ukrainian military. They were there as combatants in warfare. Now, one thing we have to distinguish is they were there as Ukrainian military. They were not there as American combatants. And there is a little bit difference. Things that Sergeant Ramirez talked about, you know, all service members in the U.S. are trained in the code of conduct. The code of conduct, while encompassing the international law of war, is also written for American combatants. They were actually over there fighting for another country. Now, Russia has gone the next step, which is they've tried to portray them as mercenaries and soldiers of fortune. And that has a very specific exception under the Geneva Convention, where they wouldn't get all the protections of a combatant as a POW, if you will. And the Russians have gone to great lengths. And that, of course, is a big concern, because if they do that, they don't have the protections, one of which is the protection against summary execution. And the Russians seem to be setting this up. Oh, my gosh.
Hal, I think that's the scary part, especially since the Kremlin spokesperson said that they could possibly face execution, which is the most terrifying part of this all. And you made a good point that these were Americans fighting on behalf of Ukraine, which, again, is why so many people are saying don't do that right now. Hal Kempfer, thank you so much for your expertise and your time tonight.
Okay, thank you, Brian.
Okay, still ahead tonight on Banfield, LSD. Yeah, LSD in the C-suite. Corporate America enlightening the workforce with psychedelics. You're not tripping. It's actually happening. We're going to show you on the other side of the break. It has been more than half a century since Timothy Leary urged the world to turn on, tune in, drop out. Though Leary himself passed on, the lure of psychedelics never really did. They went underground for decades, but now they are back, and they're not just for the counterculture anymore. Today, the regular culture, your friends, your coworkers, your quirky neighbors, they are giving LSD, mushrooms, ketamine, and other psychedelics a second look. And they're liking what they see. This is the crazy part. Even corporate America is turning to so-called psychedelic retreats, a new take on the business trip designed to help workers find clarity in their thinking and a renewed sense of energy and purpose. That's if it's all properly managed. If not, things really can get dangerous and even deadly. A book published in 2018 helped change perception of the drugs. It was written by Michael Pollan, entitled How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. It was this book that inspired one of our guests tonight to create an entire program based solely on these drugs. Jay Godfrey is the founder of Nushama, a medically supervised program of psychedelic treatments for depression, chronic pain, addiction, mood disorders, and more. A patient named Madeline was treated with ketamine at Nushama after a mastectomy for breast cancer. Madeline was in a very dark place, she says. She says she seriously considered even suicide.
Ketamine gives you an opportunity to, like, see your past traumas and then, like, try to work through them. I believe it must have been in either the third or the fourth journey where there was, like, a detachment from, like, the self and the physical body. There was me looking at that other version of myself. I was looking at that other self, like, with compassion, the scarring, which is something that, like, was affecting me a lot before. Everything just dissipated in that moment.
Okay, so my next guests have deep expertise in all of this. Amy Robbins is a clinical psychologist. Jay Godfrey is the founder of Nushama. And Rick Doblin is a drug activist and founder of the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. Amy, Jay, and Rick, thank you for being with us. Amy, I want to start with you. I'm going to be honest here. I don't know much about this. I haven't tried psychedelics, but I will say I have friends and even coworkers who have and say it was literally life-changing and it is the new thing. Explain, Amy, how does it work?
Well, I'm going to actually refer to to Dr. Doblin for that, because I think he can probably better speak to exactly how it works. I, like you, am a clinical psychologist. I'm new to exploring these medicines and in terms of just how patients are coming to me asking about them. So I've been exploring my own journey in terms of what these medicines can do and how they can help people. But I will defer to you, Dr. Doblin.
Yeah, Dr. Doblin, tell us. I mean, for people at home who don't know, how do they work?
Well, there's two basic kinds. There's the classic psychedelics like LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, ayahuasca, and then there's also MDMA. MDMA works by reducing activity in the amygdala, the fear processing part of our brain, and increasing the supply of oxytocin, the hormone of love and connection and nursing mothers, and also increasing activity in our prefrontal cortex, so we think more logically, changing our brain in exactly the opposite ways that PTSD changes our brain. And MDMA builds this sense of love, connection, and ability to process difficult emotions. The classic psychedelics work more by taking the part of our brain that is associated with our sense of self, our individuality, and that is relaxed. And there's a more emergence of more information, more connectivity, going beyond these ego states. And also in both MDMA and in the classic psychedelics, emotions that have been very difficult and have been suppressed because they're painful in one way or another, they come to the surface. And that's why these substances are so great for psychotherapy. But they've also been used for thousands of years for the spiritual experience, which is, again, this sense of connectivity, this all one, this move beyond the ego. So what we've found now is that when you support them in a therapeutic context, you can get remarkable results. And that's where we're going through the FDA. We're right now in phase 3 studies of MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD.
But Dr. Doblin, when you talk about it, it changes the brain. I got to ask you, Jay, I mean, the first thought I have, is it 100% safe and is it legal?
Well, the only legal psychedelic at the moment is ketamine, which is what we use at Nushama. There's been long debate on whether these are legal, or sorry, whether they're safe, whether they're addictive. And the DEA currently has many psychedelic molecules, including MDMA, LSD, DMT, ibogaine, and others as Schedule I drugs, meaning they are addictive and they are dangerous. But that is patently false, as thousands of years in indigenous cultures has proven. And much of the research that's being done currently by MAPS and by other organizations are bearing fruit. These are not dangerous medicines if used appropriately, and they are non-addictive. In fact, they fight addiction if they're used properly.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, we've heard scientists say other times that things are dangerous and addictive and then come to find out they're actually good for us. Amy, let me ask you, you said in the beginning that you've tried this. What was your experience like, and did it help?
So I tried it from the perspective of a licensed clinical psychologist who's really seeing the movement into psychedelics as a treatment. And it was extremely powerful. I did it under the supervision of someone who was well-trained, which I think is very important because these drugs are very powerful. We don't necessarily know how we're going to respond and react to them. And so I think that doing them under the guise of someone who can guide you through your journey is essential. It was not what I expected, but it did blow my mind. It was very powerful. I felt like I was really able to access parts of myself that you just can't get to in talk therapy, in traditional talk therapy.
I mean, was that scary though, Amy? Was it scary? I mean, some of that sounds like it would scare me a little bit.
Well, because I knew that there were people there who knew what they were doing, who had taken people on journeys before, I felt very safe, very contained, very held. And I think that's why this is so important, is that we have people there who are experienced, who know what they're doing, who know how people respond in their journeys. Because if not, yes, it could be. I would anticipate it would be very scary. But for me personally, it felt like when I looked around, when I opened my eyes, I knew that everybody who was there, who was guiding me, was there for me. And that was extremely powerful, to have In my journey, there were six other people holding the space for me. And to look around and have the experience of people being there for you was incredible. And then the integration of that. So it wasn't just that I had this journey. It was also what I did to follow and what I did before, which was to explore, okay, what do I need to do to prepare for this? How do I prepare for this? Are there things I should be eating or not eating or thinking about or meditating or breathing? And then after the experience, how was I integrating what happened to me? So I worked with an integration coach to discuss what had happened and what was continuing to happen over the coming days, weeks, and months after my psychedelic trip.
Yeah, it's certainly very, very interesting. Dr. Doblin, I want to ask you, we hear about these corporate retreats now. I mean, I can't imagine, it's hard for me to imagine my company taking all of us on a psychedelic corporate retreat, but I mean, tell us, is this becoming more common?
I think it is, and I think we have to look again at what these substances do. They bring things to the surface of the mind. We use that in therapy to handle difficult emotions, but they can also bring new ideas, creativity. You know, we hear a lot about microdosing out in Silicon Valley and other places. That's for creativity. So these substances can be used for bonding, for coming up with new ideas. But again, even then, you cannot predict what's going to happen. So when you do this on a corporate retreat, you need still some therapeutic support, just in case people start working on
that. You can't predict what's going to happen. I mean, that makes me think, gosh, like I don't know if I want to be with my coworkers and not know what's going to happen and have all of these epiphanies. Jay, let me get you in real quick. Critics have said the drugs aren't safe, that at some of these retreats, there's been robberies, rapes, even murders that have occurred. I mean, Jay, do you think it's really safe experimenting with this?
I don't think people should experiment with anything without the proper medical supervision first. Secondly, like anything and any drug, people need to be properly screened, whether there's any contraindications. For example, most psychedelics cannot and should not be used with antidepressants. Other conditions like hypertension or high blood pressure should be monitored during the experience or at least screened for that. And it's really, really important to have a proper amount of preparation with a trained therapist to help the journeyer or the patient or the voyager, whatever you want to call them, really prepare for the experience. And integration is super important. So there are many, many wonderful ways that are safe, that are done with licensed professionals who have been trained by many organizations, including Rick Doblin's MAPS. And those are the retreats that you should go to. And those are the places that are safe. I can't really speak to...
Yeah, we're just about out of time. I hear you. It does seem like you have to, if you're going to try this, you've got to do it in a controlled way with a reputable professional. Amy, Jay, absolutely. And Rick, thank you so much. Certainly eye-opening and interesting. Thank you to all three of you for coming on tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, still to come, and a woman who says she was raped and impregnated when she was 16 years old is forced to give up the child years later to her rapist and even pay him child support. If you thought when you first heard this story there's got to be more to this, well, you are right. Tonight, the father speaks and a judge speaks. We're going to have all of it when we come back. Welcome back. Dramatic new developments tonight in a story that we have covered extensively since last week. This morning, we learned of at least a temporary victory for a Louisiana woman who lost custody of her child to her rapist. A judge there ordered the child, the 16-year-old girl, moved out of the home of her biological father and sent to live with a neutral third party, at least for a few weeks, until another court hearing can take place. The girl's mother, Crystal Abelseth, told us that she had been raped and impregnated by a 30-year-old man when she was 16 years old, too young to give legal consent. She says when that man, John Barnes, found out about the child 6 years later, he asked a court for custody and got it in February. He was granted full custody of the daughter, who is now the same age her mother was when he had sex with her illegally. Last week, Abel Seth appeared on this show looking for help, and it was here that she met lawyer Jared Ambo, an expert in family law and forensic DNA, who offered to represent her pro bono. She took him up on the offer, and they both join us now. We thank you both for being with us again. We've been following the story closely. Krista, the first thing I want to get to is this new development, and I want to get your reaction, because this just happened. John Barnes has now spoken out, given his side of the story publicly for the first time. He says that there was no rape, and I want to show you the quote of what he said. He said, "She was in a bar with a fake ID, telling everyone she was a college student. I had no idea she was 16, and I didn't rape her. That is absolutely unequivocally false." Krista, what do you make of that, and did he know your real age?
I believe he did. At the very least, he knew I was in high school. I was with two other friends that were the same age as me, and they all knew us that were there.
Did he ever ask your age?
No one ever really asked me directly what my age was, but I believe that they knew.
So I want to ask you about this new development with the judge, with what happened today. Your daughter was ordered out of John Barnes' house. Did the judge explain why he made this decision? Do you think it was the media coverage? And do you know where your daughter is now?
Well, I can only assume that it was the media coverage, because if not, we wouldn't have had this hearing in the first place. Yes, I do know where my daughter is now. I was able to speak with her, and I'm very excited about that. And I feel very confident in that. Thank you.
So is she in a safe place now? Is she with another family member? I mean, I know you probably don't want to give too many specifics, but can you elaborate a little more?
Yes, I can't give the detail of exactly where she is, but she is safe, and I do trust the people that she's with.
And Jared, how do you think this plays out? I mean, obviously, this is a victory for you both today. She's no longer with this man, but what happens next?
Well, Mr. Barnes couldn't be more wrong about the felony carnal knowledge of a juvenile. It's a math problem. And ignorance of her age is not a defense. It's in the code. It's clear as can be. And so, you know, what's next for us is that we're going to collect some discovery. We're going to build a case, and we're going to present that case in full force to the judge on July 15th. And we think it will get the right outcome.
And I want to bring in a little more of what John Barnes said, just because this is new. And I want you both to be able to respond to this and set the record straight on what you have to say about it. He discussed why he says he first got custody of his daughter. And he said, "Men were coming in and out of my child's life. Krista had three husbands in 3 years, and it wasn't healthy." And he also made an allegation that Krista had an ongoing relationship with someone in prison. Krista, is that true?
No, I did not get married three times in 3 years. And I'm not seeing anyone that is in prison or was in prison.
So Jared, I mean, is this just John Barnes's way of trying to muddy the waters at this point? I mean, what do you think he's doing right now behind the scenes?
He's grasping for straws. He's in a very bad space. He is, in fact, guilty of a rape, and he is trying to make an excuse for it. And really, it's disgusting because it's victim blaming, right? Well, she shouldn't have been at the bar. I wouldn't have done that to her. She shouldn't have been wearing those clothes, or I wouldn't have raped her. And so what he's asserting is that somehow because she was at a bar, then she deserves to be raped. This is absolutely nuts. And frankly, it's not only is it muddying the water, it's muddying the water with just disgustingness. I mean, it really is foul. And I get it. Make an excuse. Whatever. None of it's going to work.
Yeah, I mean, you made a good point. The law is the law. And no matter what Krista said, it didn't matter. It was his job to make sure that she was an adult. So we've got this hearing coming up on July 15th. Jared, what happens next? What are you doing to prepare for that hearing?
So we're collecting some information. We intend to depose Mr. Barnes. I think that he'll probably plead the fifth he should, when we do so. And we are collecting the information relative to not only the fact of the ages, the birth certificates, the fact that she was under 17, he was 14 years older than her, but also everything that's happened since then, his assault and battery against her just a few weeks ago in one of the visitations that we have video of, his sexual assault, his alleged sexual assault against the daughter, and the medical evidence that we have of that. And so we plan to bring all that information to bear before the court and to give the court the full picture of what's happening so that we can have the court make the just and right decision here.
Krista and Jarrett, thank you both for coming back on with us tonight. We'll continue to follow the case closely, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you for your effort. Thank you.
Okay, I want to bring in the reporter who first broke this story and knows more about this case than pretty much anyone, the chief investigative reporter at WBRZ-TV, Chris Nakamoto. Chris, we have talked a lot about the decision made by the judge in this case. What did you think? I mean, did this come as a surprise after you've been covering this for quite some time that these changes were suddenly made at the hearing today?
It certainly did come as a surprise. We were expecting to have a contempt rule today because there were some allegations that John Barnes was not following through with the custody order where he has to provide a phone call or allow the daughter to make a phone call to Krista in the evenings. And so there was a contempt rule to basically have a hearing today. And then they didn't even rule on the contempt. Instead, he winds up revoking custody from John Barnes. It threw everybody for a loop. Nobody was expecting that to happen today.
And Chris, also something interesting. There's another woman who has come forward, an ex of John Barnes, who released a video statement basically saying, I think that she was also the victim of domestic abuse. What does she add to this? What did she say?
You know, that is quite an interesting position. We have not had, you're looking at her right there. She did release a video statement, kind of stayed somewhat neutral in that statement. But I think that this is just showing yet another pattern of somebody else who has had a custody dispute with the same individual. And so we're going to be seeing what happens on that custody hearing on July 15th. But for the judge to revoke custody from John Barnes today, and there's no real additional evidence that came out since Monday when our story came out, aside from all of this public outcry, it just shows that the ruling that was made a couple of months ago defied all logic, which is why it needed to be undone.
Yeah, isn't it funny how that happens? That's why it shows you're good at your job, Chris, because you did these stories and then suddenly there's changes. So what do you expect at the next hearing, July 15th? What sort of twists and turns do you think will take at that hearing?
I think the biggest thing that we're waiting on, this is in the district attorney's office hands. So if something happens between now and that hearing, let's say a grand jury's convened or the district attorney decides to bill him and charge him for the crime that was committed, then that will add a whole new layer of complexity. Because when he goes to that hearing, if he's locked up in jail or facing felony charges, it's going to be really hard for him to try to fight for custody of his daughter while he's facing these serious felony charges. So we're going to have to see what happens in these next few weeks as to what the district attorney does. But if he's not charged, and that was part of the argument that his attorney made in court today, he hasn't been convicted, he hasn't been charged, and all of this as a result of the sheriff's office in that community dropping the ball, taking Krista's complaint for 7 years and literally doing nothing with it. It sat on a shelf for 7 years until we started asking questions about it.
Certainly fascinating. Chris, good work. We appreciate you coming back on tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, after the break, President Biden is weighing his options to help curb the high price of gas. But a businessman in Phoenix is not waiting. He is helping his customers right now. He'll tell you how and why when we come back. Welcome back. When it comes to the price of gasoline, which is now over $5 a gallon in much of the country, there's not much any one person, even the president, can do to offer quick relief. A pause in the federal gas tax would save consumers 18 cents a gallon or 24 cents for diesel. And President Biden says it might happen.
Are you considering a pause on the federal gas tax, Mr. President? We know that you're considering it, and Secretary Gelman spoke about it yesterday.
Yes, I'm considering it.
How soon can we expect a decision?
Well, I hope I have a decision based on the data I'm looking for by the end of the week.
And while we wait, my next guest found a way to slash his gas prices by almost half a dollar, which is very, very interesting because we are always told that that is not even possible, that the gas station owners have no say, that they can't slash the prices and they're not making more money. Yet this man who we are about to meet was able to do that. His name is Jaswinder Singh. He owns a Valero Food Mart in Phoenix, where the average price of gas is a scorching $5.69 a gallon. Mr. Singh, thank you for being here. I mean, we love you. Thank you.
I've interviewed
gas station owners. I've interviewed gas station owners. They say there's no way we can't do it, yet you've slashed the prices. How did you do it?
Yes, my community love me a lot. My neighborhood love me a lot. I have to do something for them. And we lower the gas price.
I would love you too, Mr. Singh.
You can come here and fill
up. Sorry to cut you off. And listen, if I was in Phoenix, I'd drive right over. But really, how do you do it? I mean, are you losing money just to help people out?
Yes, sir. I am helping my community because whatever we make from here. Now my time is to give something to the community.
Right.
That's my our own number country, eight, yeah. My our own people.
Number six. Yes.
Man, I wish there were more people like you, Mr. Singh. That's amazing. And it sounds like you're at the gas station now. I think I hear people checking out in the background. How busy is it? I mean, is it crazy? Has word gotten out? Do you have lines of people?
Can I take you outside? You can see the people.
Yeah. Can you? Yeah, we only have like 45 seconds, but quickly, take me outside. Show me real quick.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm looking. I don't see you. You're going to take us outside? You there, Mr. Singh? Okay, it's a little blurry. I think you've got your background on, but it looks busy. Yep, it looks like all your pumps are full. There we go. I see you there. Yep. Okay. You've got the blurry background on, but still, I can tell it's busy. Thank you so much, Mr. Singh, for being here. I'm glad you got to show us around a little bit. Thanks for all you're doing. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. I appreciate you call us. And
You got it. If I'm in Phoenix, I'll come right over. I promise. Thank you so much. Okay. Gas prices notwithstanding, a lot of us feel like we need a getaway, even if our colleagues go away with us. Earlier, you saw the story in the show we discussed, Nushama, a wellness center that offers psychedelic treatments for mood disorders and overall well-being. Would you go to a work-sponsored event that included taking psychedelic drugs with your coworkers? Listen, I know my answer. I don't even have to think about it. Search News Nation of Ryan Enten on Twitter. You can vote on the poll before it closes. We're going to have your answers coming up right after the break. Okay, so before the break, we asked you, would you go to a work-sponsored event that included taking psychedelic drugs with your coworkers? An overwhelming number of you responded. Take a look. 70% of you said, no way, while the remaining 22% said yes. But the best response has been from someone named Allison Kavan, who said, it would be fun to do psychedelics with TV Ashley for sure. Well, you know what? When TV Ashley comes back from vacation, we'll let her know that you're...